Around that time, Celsius was released a dependency API, which powers maybe 60% of what HappySoup does.
That is Pablo Gonzalez, a Salesforce architect over at Salto. I'm Josh Burke, your host for the Salesforce Developer Podcast. And here on the podcast, you'll hear stories and insights from developers for developers. Today, we sit down and talk with Pablo about his project HappySoup.io, as well as other topics relating to continuous delivery and integration. Now, we are going to start, however, with his early years, where he almost had a very different career.
No, not really law enforcement. So criminology is really the prevention of crime. So it's not a reactive approach. So back in the day when I was young and naive, I thought that I wanted to kind of develop programs, not software programs, but I mean like social projects or social programs to combat the causes of crime. So the idea is you study what leads to crime, which could be poverty, lack of education, lack of opportunities. And you develop programs to attack those things to prevent crime from happening in the first place.
Interesting.
But I realize in Costa Rica that field doesn't really exist, and most people that study criminology end up in the, let's say, the Costa Rican version of the FBI. By the way, I'm from Costa Rica.
Gotcha.
And working for the, you know, Costa Rican version of the FBI can be very dangerous, and it can be very draining as well, because people just get sent to whatever location they want to send you and you have pretty much no saying.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, halfway through I realized that it wasn't for me. And at the same time, I started working in a call center doing Salesforce support. And that's kind of where I realized that I like this software thing more than getting, you know, shot in the head.
Yeah, I can. So that's kind of cool, though. You had like this really noble cause, and then you realized, as many of us do in college, that maybe life wasn't going to go that way.
Yeah.
Nice. And so then are you self-trained in software engineering, and you jumped right into Salesforce itself, right?
So I got started with Salesforce. So before Salesforce, I really wasn't into any software at all. Like, I was just a normal, I guess, normal person. You know, I knew how to use computers and all that, but I really wasn't into software. So when I was studying, I was paying for my own university fees. Yeah. So I had to have a job to do that. And I was working in a call center doing like TV support. And then they moved me to another account with this thing called Salesforce, which I thought was like some sales thing. And it was basically Salesforce. So Salesforce used to outsource their support for tier one, tier two. And it was basically that role, like a tier one role. And that kind of got me introduced to Salesforce and software in general. So then, I started later on learning on my own. I did a few courses like on networking and Cisco and things like that. But I didn't, like, I don't have a degree.
Gotcha.
So I tell my wife, I always joke, my wife is Indian. And in India, they are very strict about having a degree to work. You have to have a degree. Even if you're Bill Gates, you have to have a degree.
Right, yeah.
So I always joke that we can't move to India because I'm basically uneducated.
Sorry, honey. I'll be unemployed. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
How would you describe your current job?
Oh, it's super interesting. It's kind of, well, it's good we're doing this interview with this job, because if you had asked me, if we had this interview a few years ago, the answer would have been very different. I'm very happy, very happy. Basically, so I work for Salto. We are a small startup based in Israel, and we do DevOps for business applications. So it's not just Salesforce. We do for, well, Salesforce, obviously, but we also do DevOps for NetSuite, Zendesk, Jira, Workato, and a few others.
Gotcha.
So because we support multiple apps, the company needed someone with, you know, domain knowledge on the biggest one, which is Salesforce, to make sure that whatever we build is not too generic, but that, you know, it's, it still makes sense for a Salesforce audience, right? Because we're always kind of playing this balance between this feature needs to work for all the apps that we support, but it also needs to provide specific value for users of that application. So my job is basically to represent the Salesforce persona. So everything that has to do with Salesforce sort of goes through me. So marketing, blog posts, product features, engineering, how we solve certain problems with the API. Yeah. It's just anything that has to do with Salesforce. I'm not saying it goes through me as in approval, but I am involved in that discussion, and I provide a point of view of the eventual person that's going to use our software.
That's kind of fascinating, because so you're like not just like a Salesforce architect, but you almost have a toe in almost like marketing and developer relations itself. Like you're sort of the internal voice of the Salesforce developer slash architect.
Nice. Exactly. Yeah. I describe myself as an architect just because that's an easier. I guess at an experience level and skill level, I would categorize myself as that. Uh-huh. But in my day-to-day job in Salto, I'm not really architecting Salesforce solutions in the sense that I'm not implementing Sales Cloud or something like that.
Right.
What I'm doing is, let's say, architect or being part of the solutioning for a DevOps solution for Salesforce.
Gotcha. Nice. So, well, speaking of that architect role, let's start with Happy Soup over at happysoup.io. What's the elevator pitch for that project?
It's a free and open source software for visualizing dependencies in your Salesforce org. The most common example is figuring out where a custom field is being used, right? So if you have the
right
opportunity stage field and you're going to rename one of the stage values, you want to understand, you know, what's going to break, because you could have flows, validation rules, workflows, reports, so many things that could reference that literal value. And if you change it, then you could invalidate some logic, you could break an entire business process. So it basically scans the dependencies in your org and it provides that information in a very easy to understand output. Long story short, so that you can make changes, you know, with the confidence that, okay, I understand what would happen if I change this thing. But it also supports other stuff. It's not just fields. It supports many other metadata types. That's the gist. It does a few other things, but that's the pitch, I would say.
Gotcha. What's the origin story here? Was there a point where you're like, this is going to be easier if I just build a tool to visualize this kind of stuff as opposed to moving forward?
No, it's funny because the main driver for creating Happy Soup was imposter syndrome.
Really?
So I was at a point in my career where I felt that I was pretty decent in my knowledge of like Salesforce, Apex and all that.
Yeah.
But I don't know why around that time, so Salesforce DX and creating plugins and all that wasn't that prevalent as it is today. Yeah. But a lot of people for some reason were kind of creating, you know, this open source or like full stack apps basically. So like, you know, the guy who created Workbench, who's a Salesforce employee. I think he was in the podcast once.
Ryan Brainard, episode like 17, I want to say. He was an early one, yeah.
Yeah, so to me, that's like a genius, right?
Right.
Not only you have all the knowledge of the Salesforce API and the Salesforce core schema and all that, but you can also create a full stack application. So around the time, this was like maybe 2.5 years ago, for some reason, a lot of people in my network were kind of creating smaller apps like that. And I felt... Well, you know what imposter syndrome is like, right? You feel like, well, I'm not a real developer because all I do is Apex, and you know, deployments are basically just uploading files to an org. So I don't know anything about like real CICD or real dependency management I kind of felt I had this, you know, dumb voice in my head telling me that I wasn't a real developer, basically. Uh-huh. So I decided to listen to it and then do something about it. So I spent a few months doing some courses on Coursera for full stack development with Node.js and Vue. And around that time, Salesforce released a dependency API, which powers maybe 60% of what Happy Soup does. And so it was kind of like the, you know, the right thing at the right time. Mm-hmm. Because if it hadn't been that, I don't know what I would have done. But it just, they released it. And I thought, I tried the API and I realized this can be improved a lot because the API is pretty raw. It just gives you the result in a very raw way. And I thought there's a lot we can do with this. And I started building the product on, you know, on the weekends and evenings and all that. And it took maybe around 10 months for the initial, let's say the MVP took 10 yeah. months.
Wow. What's the future looking like with Happy Soup if the dependent, because the dependency API is being sunsetted, right?
Well, we don't know.
Okay.
So yeah, maybe about a year ago or more, Salesforce said that the API wasn't, so it never came out of beta, right? So it was mm-hmm. released as a beta API, and then it was going to be GA'd, and then it just wasn't. And
got it.
Salesforce gave a lot of explanations on the reasons. There's basically a lot of technical complexity. It requires pretty much all the different teams that own different metadata types to do something. I don't know what that is, but they yeah. need to do something in order for the dependency API to be able to catch those dependencies. And so they were going to sunset it. And
yeah.
And I made a lot of noise about that.
So they're, you're like, I spent 10 months on this guy.
Yeah, it's my 10 months for the first version. I've been doing it for 2 years now.
Yeah. Right?
So it's kind of my baby.
Yeah.
So there is a chatter group for the API. And when that news was announced, I created the hashtag GA please. You know, like generally available.
Right, please. Yeah.
And I asked a lot of people in my network to please go in to that chatter group and make a comment about GA, please.
Yeah.
And if you find that thread, it has like so many comments, so many people just either just saying GA, please, or just giving their own use case for why this API should remain.
Yeah.
So thankfully, Salesforce, you know, did take that into account. And basically what they said is that because they know that there's a lot of apps, even outside Happy Soup, like I know right. other Salesforce vendors, other products also use that API because they know a lot of people are using it in like production environments.
Yeah.
They're not going to just kill it, but there's yep. also not going to be any development.
Got it.
For the time being. So if it was sunsetted, then yeah, Happy Soup would essentially, it wouldn't die because as I said earlier, that API powers like 60% of what it does. I also have yeah. a lot of my own logic to figure out dependencies, mm-hmm. but it will become just, it will give such an incomplete picture that,
right.
that it may not even be worth using it. So it would essentially die. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Well, hashtag GA please. I like it. I like it a lot.
Yeah. But, you know, I've created other products or mm-hmm. smaller things since then. So I've kind of moved on because it did affect me, to be honest, like emotionally when I saw those news, because I was like, you know, this thing is my kind of my source of validation, you know, to be honest.
Right.
Like I created this thing to feel better about myself and people right. are using it and I like it and people tell me all these good things about it. And then for it to just disappear, it would, you know, it's a loss.
Right. Yeah. Seriously.
Yeah. So I did have some time where I was kind of sad about that, but mm-hmm. it's been a while and I've created other products since then and I've kind of, I'm at peace with it. You know, if it goes okay. away, then I know it's not my fault and
yeah,
and whatever.
There are several things we can control in this world. And one of them is not whether or not Salesforce takes something out of pilot.
yeah, exactly. Unless yeah. you are higher up the chain. Then
weirdly high. Yeah. I mean, my hope right now is there is a product manager internally at Salesforce. I'm not sure who it is. I still actually remember the first time I saw this demoed internally. And it was like, at the time, it was like somebody's kind of like pet project to like kind of prove that it could actually work. And the demo itself, just like, it was just like a meeting full of product managers. The demo itself just took over the entire meeting because everybody's just like, oh my God, everybody could use this kind of thing. So yeah. Fingers crossed for you. One Thanks. More note, when I was looking into this, I had not heard this term before. So walk me through it. What are deployment boundaries and how does Happy Soup work with it?
Yeah, so that's a term that I made up, which is probably the reason you hadn't heard of it before.
I like it.
So it's funny because that was the original reason I created Happy Soup. Like when I set out to create Happy Soup, I wasn't thinking of like impact analysis or where is this used kind of use case. My initial intention was that, you know, scratch orgs and, you know, unlock packages and the whole idea of breaking up your org into packages is actually very complicated in real life.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I was thinking is that, well, it wouldn't be so hard if you could take a top level component. So let's imagine a trigger, like, okay, I have the lead, or let's say the opportunity trigger. And if I could figure out what the trigger is using, let's say, okay, it's using one Apex class, the opportunity trigger handler.
Yeah.
And if I could then figure out what that class is using, let's say it's using some fields, and maybe those fields are using, well, fields don't use anything, but they do if they're formula fields.
Right.
Right. So it's using maybe an object, and that object has a record type, and that record type controls some pick list values, etc. If I could figure out recursively all the way onto the last, you know, item, that all these things are somehow related to that top level component, I can draw a boundary around that and basically take a chunk of my org, like export it with the metadata API, and in theory, then put that in a scratch org so that I can then do development on that top level component. So the use case is, for example, if I want to modify the Apex trigger in a scratch org, in real life, as I said, it's not possible because there's just so many things that trigger would use. But if you could take everything that the trigger depends on to exist and preload the scratch org with that metadata, then you can actually deploy the trigger to that org and do whatever changes you want. And the trigger, let's say, won't know that it's not in its source org because it has everything it needs to exist. So that was the idea of Happy Soup, and that's why I gave the name Deployment Boundary. And it's funny because I showed it to a colleague of mine a few years ago, and he liked it, and he was like, "Yeah, it's nice, but can you do that reverse so I can see where a field is used?" And I'm like, "Yeah, actually, I can." And turns out that's the most popular use case.
Gotcha.
So if I had just released the original version, which was deployment boundaries, probably nobody would use it.
Well, first of all, I love that idea. You're like giving yourself a safe little island in order to work on things. But then my guess is I don't want to say the reverse of that, but the other use case is kind of, because the other thing that happens is that somebody just doesn't realize somebody for some reason is referencing that one custom field, and that's the reason why their flow is breaking or something like that. And so the flip side is that Happy Soup allows you to make sure that the map is showing you all those connected dots.
Exactly. Yeah. But so the term deployment boundary, so it works in principle. Like I have an example documented somewhere where I did just that, where I took an Apex trigger that depends on a bunch of different things, and I just exported the package XML with Happy Soup of the deployment boundary, deploy it to a scratch org, and create an unlock package out of that, which is it's amazing. But in real life, if you give that to a real org, it will only give you, like, let's say, I don't know, 70% of the picture, but it's still good enough, you know,
because
there isn't any other software today that allows you to recursively inspect dependencies from top to bottom to understand everything that needs to exist for that top level component to exist in a target org. So it's still useful.
Gotcha. Now, not everybody might be comfortable with the idea of logging into a web-based application and basically throwing their credentials out, having you scour their org. What are the deployment options that people can use for Happy Soup?
Yeah, so you can deploy to your own Heroku account. So there's a deploy to Heroku button.
Nice.
So the app is a Heroku account. Sorry, Heroku app. So you can deploy to your own Heroku account. It's pretty simple. You just need to set some environment variables for a few things, but it literally takes 10 minutes. You can also use it locally, as in just git clone the project and then build it there and run it locally. And you can also use it in Docker. So there's a Docker image for HappySoup.
Gotcha.
It's better than using it locally as in Git clone, because then all the dependencies are already there. It comes with the Redis database and the Express server and everything.
Nice.
So I know some people use the Docker version.
Okay. Nice.
So that, it, I mean, I think I covered pretty much all the possible scenarios. One thing though is I'm going to start working in the next few months on making HappySoup a CLI plugin.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice.
That's going to be another pet project, because I also realized that, well, some people may not want to use any of those things, or they may not want the UI, and there may have some use case where you need to extract dependencies, you know, in a scripted way.
Right.
So the good thing is that HappySoup, the web app, as you know, it's HappySoup.io, is actually just a wrapper, like a, let's say, a front and back end wrapper.
Gotcha.
For an NPM package that I also created, of course, called SDC Soup.
Okay.
And that is the actual core logic that extracts all the dependencies. And that package can work in any context, because it's totally agnostic. You just need to pass a connection and like an ID of what you're looking for, and it'll give you those things.
Got
so
it.
To translate that into a, or convert it into a CLI plugin, it's just using that Node.js package and just passing it the ID of what you're looking for, and that's it. So it should be pretty straightforward.
Very, very cool. Yeah, I think you should feel very validated for being a full stack developer at this point.
Yeah, I'm a real developer now. Yes, I feel like a real one.
Yeah. So let's talk about another project you have, and I want to walk through this verbally so that people get it. The project, Not Another CI, aka NACI, which is over at salto.io. So serious bonus geek points for the wordplay. People can walk that through that acronym through their head. I think they'll eventually get there. Give me the elevator pitch for that one. What's that project about?
So about the name is because Salto has this is not a Salto project. This is my project, but we host it on Salto's website because in the future it'll benefit us, and I'll explain why in a second.
Okay. But,
so Salto has this, I guess I need to give some background. I can't just explain this without giving some background. So the way Salto works is we translate the Salesforce metadata and the metadata of any other business app into our own language.
Okay.
That language is based on the Terraform language, and we basically have like a whole type system to describe the configuration of a business app. That language is called NACL, which stands for Not Another Configuration Language.
Gotcha.
So in Salto, we like using this Not Another XYZ theme a lot. So like when we went to Dreamforce and TDX a few months ago, also if you went to our booth, our, what do you call it? Not title, I forgot, like our catchphrase is Not Another DevOps Vendor.
Got it.
we play a lot with this thing because it differentiates us a lot.
Yeah.
So when I was thinking for the name of this, I thought let's just keep the trend, and so I call it Not Another CI tool, or not another continuous integration tool, and we call it NACI. It's pronounced NACI.
NACI. Okay. Okay.
Okay. So long story short, so basically, what it is a way for you to create an entire continuous integration configuration file with, you know, point and click. So let's give the example of GitHub Actions, right? If you're doing continuous integration with GitHub Actions, you need to create a YAML file based on some GitHub Actions, you know, I guess guidelines. They have their own, not their own language, but their own implementation on top of YAML of how you define, like, you know, what job it is or what kind of filters, if the job runs when a pull request is open or when it's closed. They have their own way to define if you want to call a bash script or Node.js. So even though most continuous integration servers, they use YAML, they all do it in a different way.
Got it.
So when I was learning CI/CD maybe about a year ago, I realized that creating that whole YAML file, it has two problems. One is you need to do it by hand, and and it's just very time consuming. But the most important thing that I realized is that it's not random. There are patterns to this. A lot of people are doing the same. Like people are doing, let's say, a static code analysis when a pull request is open.
Right.
Or people are doing a Delta deployment instead of deploying the entire branch. Or, I don't know, we keep the org OAuth URL in a secret of the CI server. So there's a lot of things that, there are a lot of patterns that actually repeat themselves across any CI server.
Yeah.
And so the idea is that it's twofold. It's one, if you don't know CI/CD well, you may not even be aware of those patterns. So you may not know, well, how do I implement CI? Should I, like, what should happen when a pull request is open? Should I do a validation deployment? Should I do a full deployment to an integration sandbox? So you don't know. And even if later you do know those things, then you need to figure out how to represent that in a YAML file. So Naki is supposed to abstract those two things in one go. So it's basically, it's a very simple UI that it kind of asks, it's kind of like a wizard where it walks you through those questions that eventually become patterns. Like, okay, what are you looking for? What do you want to do? Do you want to deploy? Do you want to run tests? Then let's say if you say, I want to deploy, then it's going to ask you, okay, when? Do you want to deploy when a pull request is open, when a push is made on a branch? If you choose a branch, then it'll ask you, okay, what is the branch name? So it kind of walks you through this thought process, right, that may not be obvious to a lot of people.
Right.
And once you've gone through that, then there's a button that, you know, you click generate, and it basically creates the entire YAML file for GitHub Actions with all the settings that you selected. So it speeds up development of continuous integration because, one, you don't need to think about, you know, the patterns that you may not even know exist. And two, it automatically creates the entire YAML file for you.
Gotcha. It's one of the things I love that's pretty consistent in your blog post and your content is you're sort of like, at the end of it, you're like, this is the YAML file we just created. Please use it as, you know, kind of a boilerplate for if you don't know where to start from a CI/CD point of view, here's where you go. And I love that because it's like package.json for CI/CD. It's like, you know, you need it. You know, there's a format for it. You're not entirely sure of all the working bits. Here's an example.
Yeah, exactly. But I think, so it would be very easy to create examples. And actually, there are examples. There is a, like, if you Google continuous integration Salesforce, one of the Google hits is on a Salesforce developer site. I think it's about SFDX or something like that. And somewhere there, Salesforce has these examples of continuous integration in different CI servers. There are examples of, you know, how to do it in CircleCI, GitHub Actions, Bitbucket pipelines. So it could have been, you know, very easy for me to just put those things in like a Google Doc and say, okay, here are some templates. But to me, that's not enough because then you just paste a template and you don't know why it's doing what it's doing.
Right.
So I wanted it to kind of walk you through that, you know, thought process that, you know, are you deploying to which environment, why, when should it happen? And that kind of almost educates you, right?
Yeah.
On the spot as to how a continuous integration pipeline should work.
Nice.
So at the moment, it only supports GitHub Actions, and I plan to introduce support for Bitbucket and GitLab. But it takes time, and I have a lot of other, you know, side projects, and I have a real baby at home as well.
gotcha.
And that takes most of my time these days. So I need to be very ruthless with prioritizing things. Like if it's not super critical, then it just doesn't get done. That's it. Like I just don't even spend time on things that are not really critical.
Well, and I appreciate the fact that you're leaning into your parent voice and not your imposter syndrome voice. So.
Yeah, of course.
Tell me a little bit about designing for CI in general. Like, we could probably spend a whole other episode on some of the stuff, but like, what are some things that before people actually start building out their pipelines, what do you think there are some things that people should think about?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that I actually think that creating the pipeline is pretty much the last step.
Gotcha.
Is the culmination of an entire thought process.
Yeah.
So there are different things. Let's say, for example, the sandbox strategy. Yeah. The sandbox strategy has 100%, in my opinion, an influence on everything you do after that.
Sure.
It'll influence your Git branching strategy, because mm-hmm. it's not the same having two sandboxes versus five. Then mm-hmm. you need to decide, should every sandbox have a branch? And if so, you know, how do I merge them? Or do we only use one branch and we deploy to all sandboxes using tags or something like that? So even something as simple as how many sandboxes you have
yeah.
is going to influence everything after that. So to me, that's kind of the foundation. So that's one thing, defining a well thought out sandbox strategy, which, you know, could mean everyone having a developer sandbox and then maybe mm-hmm. a QA or integration sandbox. I also advocate to the idea, or no, I don't advocate, but I don't criticize the idea of a shared sandbox, right? Because a lot of people,
okay.
of course, if you say this in public, people are like, oh my God, you know, are you actually saying that it's like, you know, it's such a bad practice, you know, you're it's misinformation, right? But like, you know, it's very, very easy for you to say, oh, everyone should have a personal sandbox. That's yeah. a very easy statement to say. You just say it and that's it. Nothing happens.
Yeah.
There are many huge Salesforce organizations that they're working with a lot of complexity in their Salesforce right. org. A lot of, I'll give an example that I used to work in a company where the developer sandbox or like the personal sandbox was pretty much useless without production like data, because mm-hmm. and this wasn't mm-hmm. on purpose. It was kind mm-hmm. of accidental that as the complexity of the org grew, so many, let's say, code paths, you know, or different execution paths of the code were yeah. derived by field values on like 10 different custom objects. And the reason I say accidental is because this could also be on purpose. If you think of a package like CPQ, a lot of the configuration is done on custom objects. That is a conscious decision. That's how you right. configure CPQ. And then their Apex code, which we cannot see, but for sure their Apex code, you know, sort of reads that configuration from those objects and it behaves differently.
Yeah.
This wasn't a design choice. This just was the natural evolution of that org was that there could be 10 permutations of a single Apex class based on the values of 10 different custom objects. So what it meant is was that, again, if you have a developer sandbox, it was super hard to reproduce anything, whether it's a bug or a new feature or an enhancement.
Yeah.
We were almost never sure that is this actually going to work unless, you know, until that code or change reached UAT. And then we could test that, okay, it works. I know I'm going on a tangent here, but what I'm saying, and there are ways to fix this, and right. I'm not advocating to not fixing it, but there are some scenarios where, let's say, if you have a project that is like that, where you really need a lot of data,
yeah,
you could work on a shared sandbox for maybe two or three developers, no more. Mm-hmm. Maybe those guys are focused on that project. They have their own process for that very specific circumstance. And mm-hmm. let's say everyone else can work on their own, you know, on different projects, you know, on their own sandbox. It could also be that you are working on a project that requires integration with different systems and mm-hmm. it's really hard to configure multiple sandboxes to be integrated in the exact same way with MuleSoft, Workato, Slack, etc. So for gotcha. Those scenarios as well, it may make sense to use a shared sandbox for a few developers. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I'm not like, oh, you have to have, you know, one sandbox per developer and period.
Right.
Because we don't know all the Salesforce orgs that exist out there. So the point I'm trying to make is that you need to make a conscious choice about what your sandbox strategy is going to be. And mm-hmm. if that conscious choice is that, well, for this specific project, we're going to use a shared sandbox because of these reasons, then that's okay.
Yeah.
That's fine. And you can work around that. So that's one of the first, I guess, kind of pillars to continuous integration. That, as I said earlier, also influences your branching strategy. Mm-hmm. If you're going to have one branch per org, or if you're going to use something like GitFlow, where you just have like a main branch and then a development branch where everything yeah. gets merged into, or if you're going to do something like trunk-based development, which most people don't do in Salesforce. There are other foundational things, like also a very important one is deciding what are you going to actually put in Git. Because doing continuous integration doesn't mean that your entire org needs to be dumped into a Git repo.
Right.
Again, it's all about making conscious choices. You can make a conscious choice that we're going to just do CI/CD for code-based metadata. So Apex, Visual Force, Lightning Web Components, etc., S controls. I'm joking. anything that is code, let's say, okay, we're going to do it in, you know, CI/CD. And again, maybe we have other teams, we have contractors that come in and out, etc. Yeah. Maybe we have super users that are allowed to modify, let's say, email templates in production or in UAT. So it just needs to be a conscious choice that, okay, we're going to track this much metadata in Git to do CI/CD on that. And also, if you're starting out, like if you don't know anything about CI/CD and SFDX and all that, trust me, you don't want to be dealing with all the different quirks of the metadata API, like with profiles and all these very complicated objects. So very important as well to make a conscious choice as to what are you going to track in Git.
What are you actually biting off?
Again, it's not all or none. It could be just a small subset of metadata, and you can always add more stuff as you progress in your DevOps journey. So I'll stop there. But those are like three foundational, I guess, topics or thought patterns that you should be thinking of before you even go and write.
And that's our show. Now, before we go, I did ask after Pablo's favorite non-technical hobby, and well, it's a tasty one.
What would that be? I guess eating and
yeah, okay, and
cooking. Yeah,
nice.
I love food, so like if I want to shut my brain off, I'll just watch some YouTube videos on cooking, especially Indian food. As I said, my wife is Indian, and yeah, Indian food kind of ruins you because it's just so tasty that
I know.
That just that everything else just feels bland, you know, like my taste buds are, they don't respond to other things anymore. Nerve endings don't work anymore.
I feel you. Like my 2017 trip to India, I'm like, I know this sounds so dumb. Like, man, the Indian food in India is so good.
It's so good. Yeah. Especially in India. It's really, really good. So I really enjoy that. I don't have that much time these days again because I have a toddler at home. But before that, I used to cook a lot. Maybe once a week, we would make something special, something new. So I would say in general, eating and cooking.
I want to thank Pablo for the great conversation and information. As always, I want to thank you for listening. If you want to learn more, check out the show notes at developer.salesforce.com/podcast, where you can also hear old episodes and links to your favorite podcast service. Thanks again, everybody, and I'll talk to you next week.